Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And I understand that many African Americans distrust my political party. I consider it a tragedy that the party of Abraham Lincoln let go of his historic ties with the African-American community.
President Bush speaking before a tough crowd today as he addressed the NAACP's National Convention in Washington. It was a first for Bush, the longest a president has gone without addressing the storied civil rights group since Herbert Hoover. At another point in his lengthy speech, responding to tepid applause, the president said he'd asked for pointers from the group's chairman and then joked, "They're not going over that well." Well, the White House says the president has been boycotting the group because its leadership frequently criticizes the administration. Some observers see today's visit as a political move during an election year. The White House says it's a moment of opportunity to mend fences as Bush enters the autumn of his presidency. Well, Daryl Fears is a Washington Post reporter. He covered the convention. And, Daryl, that was quite a moment when the crowd sort of acknowledged that the Republican Party has lost them.
Yes, I think that Bush did a very good job in a very folksy delivery and a conciliatory delivery, and saying he asked them. I know a lot of you are saying that it's been too long, and they reacted to that. And then he laid out some programs that African Americans care about.
Well, the president brought up subjects he's been criticized for, especially in the black community, including his response to the Gulf Coast, No Child Left Behind, risky subjects. He defended these policies. You spoke to the Reverend Jesse Jackson right afterwards. How did the president's defense go over?
Well, Reverend Jesse Jackson praised the Bush's actions on the Voting Rights Act. But he also denounced some of the things that his administration has done, such as the Justice Department approving voter ID in Georgia that will require people to get some type of identification that they actually have to pay for. That wouldn't have gone over in past administrations. And he also criticized the effort in New Orleans, where during the mayor's race, he didn't feel that the administration made enough arrangements for African Americans to vote in that election. But he compared it to Iraqis being able to vote worldwide in that election. And so that was Reverend Jesse Jackson's reaction. But I think that when I talk to people who attended the convention, people who attended the speech, delegates, delegates were very won over by it. The only thing they really didn't like was this talk about No Child Left Behind or charter schools. In fact, there were some sharp and very loud boos of the president.
Because he said, what about charter schools? What did they disagree with?
Well, he supports charter schools. He wants to expand. He wants to reach out to children who are failing through charter schools. But the NAACP's position on charter schools is that funding them will take money away, even more money away, from very impoverished public schools. And he said the people who are paying taxes to fund public schools will now fund charter schools that many of their kids can't attend. And they are very much opposed to that.
Well, Daryl, just got about a minute. I want to ask you, a key factor in getting the president to come today was the NAACP's new president, Bruce Gordon, a former Verizon executive who said he's made it his mission to mend fences with Bush. Some people say the NAACP needs the president as much as he needs them and their votes, that they're in danger of becoming irrelevant. Your thoughts?
That's interesting how the president acknowledged that. They talked about working together, but there's a very interesting story also behind how the president came here. I saw Bruce Gordon, I saw Julian Bond, and I saw Ben Hooks, an old president, and each played a role in lobbying the president. Julian Bond, of all people, who said the Republican, the extreme right wing of the Republican Party was like the Taliban wing, collared the president at a correspondence dinner, apparently, and really tried to mend fences there.
They both seem to need each other. Daryl Fears, a reporter with The Washington Post, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, turning to South Africa, where officials are condemning a racist cell phone ringtone, which has been circulating on the internet. It's a song that refers to blacks with the outlawed slur kafir and calls for them to be dragged behind pickup trucks. Well, if South Africans are still struggling in the aftermath of apartheid, a new book stands as a reminder of how far the country has come. The Syringa Tree is actually a novel based on a play, both written by actress Pamela Geens, who tells the story of growing up in a white activist family, fiercely opposed to their beloved country's apartheid policies. The Syringa Tree was an extraordinary one-woman show in which Pamela Geen embodied 26 characters, sometimes several in the space of a few seconds. In this scene, she plays a beloved black gardener, then herself as a child, then a policeman warning blacks to get out of the white suburbs by nightfall.
Sometimes, like magic, everyone disappears. Into the granadilla bushes, up into the syringa tree, under Salamina's bed.
Police! Police! Pass! Pass!
Well, now, for those of us who loved the play The Syringa Tree, I've personally seen it four times, there is The Syringa Tree, a novel. And playwright and author Pamela Geen joins us again in the studio to tell us more. Nice to see you again.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And as we said, there is some fiction here, but this is largely the story of your family, your life. How would you characterize them, by the way? And how would you characterize you as a child?
Well, gosh, a lot of people have asked me how I was as a child, since the child in the Syringa Tree is such a strong little character. And honestly, I don't remember really how I was as a child, but I certainly remember what I felt as a child. And so I think Syringa Tree is invested largely with my feelings, the fear, the chaos of Africa, and the magic, the joy of an African childhood. Anybody who ever set foot on that soil will tell you the magic of the place.
The magic is one thing, but the fear that you mentioned is so palpable in the stage play. I mean, here's this little girl practically trembling when she thinks her beloved black friends aren't going to get out of the white suburbs in time, or mm-hmm. if she thinks some secret is going to be found out. The Christian Science Monitor reviewer Yvonne Zipp compares the book favorably to Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh my gosh, I had not seen that one, but thank you.
Well, she points out what she calls explicit parallels. Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird was a tomboy, so is your character Lizzie, the stand-in for you as a child. Atticus Finch, a saintly lawyer, your father, the character, a saintly doctor. Both Scout and Lizzie were raised by beloved housekeepers. In your book, that's Salamina. Mm-hmm. You'd never seen those parallels?
No, I know the book, obviously, and I love the book. I suppose those parallels exist because it's through the eyes of a child and it's through a tumultuous time and it's to do with race. Hmm. But I think the family is so different in the sense, and the landscape is so different, the life is so different, and what they're dealing with is so different. But I would say yes, I mean, in feeling probably, because it's through the eyes of a child. And, you know, I think one of the strengths of the book, The Syringa Tree, as a play and as the novel now, is that the voice of the narrator never lectures at you or tells you what to think or tries to sway you politically one way or another. And I felt that so strongly as my responsibility as the author of the novel, to not engage in that, just as the play doesn't engage in that. It allows the audience freely to come with their imagination, their feelings, and to decide for themselves what they feel about apartheid.
And just for those who hadn't seen the play, to point out how extraordinary that is, that you keep that even keel. You do so even though your grandfather was brutally murdered by a machete-wielding a freedom fighter.
From Zimbabwe. Well, you know, I explore that question in the novel. What does it mean to fight for freedom? And does attacking an 82-year-old man who has never harmed you and is beloved of the people who work on his farm,
the blacks,
is that about fighting for freedom? And that's a question that now, sadly, you know, all around Zimbabwe and farmers are being attacked, and so the food supply is, you know, dwindling, and there are so many consequences and problems. So I try to write to that question, what does it really mean to fight for freedom? What does it mean to stand for freedom? I mean, the way that Mandela has stood for freedom, extending his hand to South Africans when he was released, not from a place of resentment or a punitive place, but from a place of forgiveness. So I don't like to say he was a freedom fighter. That's what the police how they referred to him at the time. But there's so many unsung heroes in South Africa who are real freedom fighters, people who worked underground. My own brother-in-law, who worked in the black unions creating education opportunities for young black children by providing better examination papers and better opportunities for them to study. I mean, those people were followed around by the secret police for those simple efforts at the time.
And those, like Salamina, the composite character that's your mother surrogate, who just by living and getting up every day to go to work and worked in the white homes and then went home to their own townships to poor health care and living and still were so loving towards you.
Yes, I mean, I've really tried to honor in both the play and the novel, and I think this is what audiences of Seringatree really love in the play, is the relationship between Elizabeth and Salamina, because so many of them, I get hundreds of letters from South Africans saying, oh, I had a Salamina. I had this nanny who cared for me. I've had letters from Americans who grew up in the South saying, you know, there was a woman who took care of me. I don't remember her name now, but I remember how she held me. I remember her, the skin, her cheeks, you know. So there's such a deep bond between a child and that very first caretaker. In South Africa, what's so moving is that because of apartheid, children had to live separated from their parents in the townships, usually taken care of by an aging grandparent, and the parent would be in the white household, not able to, even because there were no cell phones in those days, communicate with the child. You know, you couldn't call your child and say, did you do your homework? Did you eat your lunch? None of that. They would, you know, if they were lucky, someone would come with a message from the township if the child was ill, and then maybe they would see the child once a week if they were able to travel back into the townships on their one day off or 2 days off. So very, very stressful, debilitating to the black family unit. And the thing that's so moving to me as an adult now looking back is I never felt resentment from the nannies or the women who cared for me as a child ever. I only ever felt love from them and what they must have been feeling inside, what they were living with every day. So the Seringatree, in the relationship between Elizabeth and Salamina, tried to honor the black women of South Africa who were so extraordinary in their grace and compassion with us. The Salamina in the novel is a combination of a couple of different women who cared for me, but she certainly has the spirit of most of the South African Khoza women, or the black women who
say that again. It's X H O S A.
X H O S A Khoza. Yeah. Khoza. Took me a long time as a white girl to get that right. Even when I was in South Africa doing the play, we took it to Cape Town and had this fabulous Nosi Bosiso was the...
Had fabulous what?
The woman working backstage with me, she was a Khoza woman named Nosi Bosiso. And I kept practicing my clicks for all I was worth with her backstage because I was in front of a South African audience. And I said to her one day, Nosi, do I have it? Do I have it? She said to me, what? You are getting there, Pemi. You are getting there.
Could you do, please, the reading from the book that demonstrates Salamina and Lizzie's relationship?
Sure.
Well, actually, what we'll do is we're going to take a very brief break, and you will not want to miss actress and author Pamela Geen reading from The Seringatree, a novel. We'll have that for you when we come back. Much more coming up, including Anthony Cordesman later on in the program, Policy in the Middle East. You won't want to miss that either. Stay with us here and now. We're from South African actress Pamela Geen, author of The Seringatree, her novel of growing up under apartheid, also the title of her one-woman play. Before the break, we asked Pamela to read a section that really shows the loving relationship between Lizzie, the little white girl at the center of the story, and her black nurse and caretaker, Salamina, who's pregnant, and the whole family's been trying to keep that secret from the white Afrikaner neighbors.
Well, this is a part that takes place in the laundry room where Elizabeth has been warned not to tell about the impending birth of Salamina's baby because it will be shipped back to the township. And she's very impatient about the baby, you know, arriving. And she says to Salamina, you know, is the baby ever going to be born? Salamina tells her, yes, the baby's coming any day now. Elizabeth says, the magic of the baby so close silenced me. I had long planned to tell him hello. In his own language, I would say, Dumela, Dumela Ache, to him, just as Salamina greeted anyone who came to our gate. Dumela Ache, au mangi. Salamina covered my head with her delighted hand. You are my little piccanini.
I'm not a piccanini, I'm big. Sing me my wedding song.
Oh, you are getting married, Miss Lizzie, she played along.
Sing to me, O maid of honour,
I commanded her to carry my jewel-encrusted train.
No, Mike, I am too tired. I've got a big, big ironing to do, she said sternly.
Oh, sing to me, Sally, I'm a bride.
With sweat beading on her lip, she dunked her hand into the battered jam tin filled with water and flicked the drops onto a carefully folded sheet on the ironing board. And because singing takes less effort than arguing, her mouth opened in a deep melody.
Oh, Pamela Geen, please tell me you've done an audio book.
Oh,
your book.
Thank you, Robin.
Have you?
We might indeed do one. Well, you know, I tried so much to capture it on the page in terms of the different dialects and to create the different characters in the way that they speak on the page. So,
it's just amazing to sit here.
Thank
and
you,
watch
Rob.
You go in and out of these characters. Do you?
Thank you.
Do you still? I mean, in that moment, were you embodying Salamina and Lizzie? And
yes, I think so. You know, I've had the privilege and the great pleasure of living with these characters for 7 years, mm-hmm. traveling around, you know, to London and now Cape Town and Vancouver most recently, and so they live within my spirit and my body, and you know, I try to honor them. And then writing the book too, I think. Because I had the great luck of performing them, I deeply know them.
The set for the play is very spare. Mm-hmm. But in the book, you really watercolor and paint for us the landscape, which is also, of course, a main character in the play. Would you do us a favor? Can we leave with just a quick reading of the description of your grandfather's farm, Lizzie's grandfather's farm, and what that landscape meant to her?
The soft whine of the gate opened to Clover. There was nothing gorgeous about Clover, except the feeling you had when you were there. It was just a simple place, a beloved refuge in the looming, graceful shadow of the Sopansberg Mountains, 5 hours north of Johannesburg, and in the opposite direction, almost but not quite, by 2 days' driving, you would be as far south as you can go on the continent of Africa. Just a dusty farm, really. A quiet place to run wild with the piccaninnies by day, and when the sun gave up, so did you, falling into exhausted sleep, scrubbed and smelling of violets and camphor cream for new burnt patches. An old place, to run free as a monkey and filthy as you pleased. Bursting barefoot from the car out into the rose-brown furrows, you knew for certain you were in a lucky place.
Pamela Geen reading from her new book, The Syringa Tree, a novel, the novel version of her play, The Syringa Tree. And just briefly, you left South Africa in anger because of the events that were unfolding during apartheid. You've returned several times since, seen the caretakers who raised you, put on the Syringa Tree in South Africa. What's your feeling about the country now?
Well, you know, I would say I left in sadness and anger, like a lot of people. And also, I must add that I had a curiosity about the world as a young person might. So it was a complicated event for me. But I'd say South Africa now, you know, my feelings when I've been back there, I've been so enchanted, really, by the sense of optimism in South Africa. There are still enormous problems with poverty, the consequence of apartheid, the fact that you know, entire generations were not educated and now will never have the chance to catch up. AIDS, just AIDS. I mean, I was in a taxi the other day and the cab driver said to me, have we not had enough in Africa? He was an African man, and he said, have we not had enough? Why now AIDS? You know, it seems you know, like a plague of sad struggles that the African people face. But in the midst of all that, I had such a sense of joyful optimism, ownership, freedom in the country, and a real sense of dignity now that people can move forward through these problems. I spoke with John Carney, the magnificent actor here, and something he said to me resonated so deeply for me. He said, "You know, Pammy," he said, "we have so many problems still in South Africa. We're still, many of us, walking along the side of the road in a flinterbroek, and South Africans will know that means a raggedy pair of pants or trousers. We're still walking in raggedy trousers, some of us, but now we walk with faces up." Mm. And it so captured the bounty that freedom brings to a country, the spirit of the people there. Even, you know, the moment you land at that airport, people are running with carts and, you know, helping you, and there's just a whole other feeling. It's you know, I wept when I arrived, I wept when I left, I've been back a couple of times since, and it's a deeply emotional experience for me every time.
Yeah. And now, I see.
Yeah, and now.
Pamela Geen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. You're a pleasure to speak with. I appreciate so much you having me in.
And once again, Pamela Geen's novel is The Syringa Tree. It's based on her one-woman show. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBU.
Israeli troops are meeting strong resistance from Hezbollah fighters in southern Lebanon today as both sides continue to shower the region with missile fire. The toll on Lebanese civilians, upwards of 300 dead and 500,000 displaced, is causing international consternation. Russia saying the Israeli reaction has gone far beyond the boundaries of an anti-terrorist operation. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan calling for an immediate halt to the escalating conflict. The Bush administration, on the other hand, has vocally supported Israel's right to defend herself, saying that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice will not travel to the region for at least a week. The administration has also said that talks with Syria, a supporter of Hezbollah, are pointless since previous meetings with that government have proven fruitless. So what now? Well, in the first of an occasional look at possible strategies for the Middle East, we turn today to Dr. Anthony Cordesman, a security analyst with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Anthony, your take on the U.S. role in the current crisis.
Well, the United States, effectively by standing aside, has given a green light to Israel. It's not clear what it's green light for. It's simply not clear that by going on escalating, Israel can accomplish anything. If it cannot somehow force Lebanon or the Lebanese government to bring the Hezbollah under control, and simply defeating the Hezbollah on the field and occupying southern Lebanon leaves Israeli forces exposed, is extremely costly, and is dealing with an enemy that can disperse and bury its weapons. So the U.S. has essentially abdicated in many ways. It's refused to have dialogue with the countries that might influence Hezbollah. It won't support a meaningful international force to go in. It really is neither moving toward a ceasefire that could reduce the tensions and anger or anything that would stop the Hezbollah from being a threat in the future.
So what do you think has happened here? I mean, you know, some are saying, as it seems that you're indicating, the U.S. Should have become more involved much earlier on in the crisis, and that's the mistake that now puts the U.S. on the sidelines. But others are saying this was a smart part of a plan on the part of the U.S. to stand back and let Israel counterattack against a militant group that wouldn't disarm, as the U.N. had called for, that this is, you know, part of a strategy.
Well, if it's part of a strategy, the problem is, what's the end game? Because if Israel can't disarm Hezbollah, and it can't, if it really advances into Lebanon and makes itself more vulnerable at immense cost, that doesn't mean Israel wins. If there is no one on the outside to either disarm the Hezbollah or create any kind of security buffer that might help Israel be more secure, this is essentially escalating to nowhere.
You're also saying that the U.S. hands are tied when it comes to brokering a diplomatic solution with the two countries that could perhaps have influence on Hezbollah, Iran and Syria. So given that, what can the U.S. do in the region?
Well, I think first, a lot of the problem occurs because the U.S. had stood aside, perhaps because of preoccupations over Iraq, from any truly active, high-profile effort before this to deal with what was happening in Lebanon. It also, frankly, by refusing to talk to states, which are in many ways hostile, a lot of the charges about Iran and Syria are perfectly accurate, but it's cut itself off from dialogue. By not working with the Europeans, it has also deprived itself of voices which can often put effective pressure, not in any sudden or dramatic ways, but at least to make things better. By isolating itself from the United Nations, it has in many ways made itself seem allied to Israel in escalating without offering any options at all.
Anthony Cordesman, what happens now? I mean, you speak of there being no endgame in sight. Can you try to picture one?
Well, you have two endgames that you could really try for. One is you're willing to try, at least, to get an international force to work with the Lebanese that would go in under the guise of being enforcing a ceasefire, but with the clear understanding that it would actually be supporting the Lebanese in disarming Hezbollah. That is a difficult step to take, and any effort may well fail, but to not even try ensures failure. The other is to at least try for a balanced approach to this situation, to keep trying to put Israel under pressure for restraint, to not simply have open-ended escalation when it isn't clear that Israel can achieve any strategic results, and a great deal of harm is going to be done not only to the Lebanese, but potentially to the U.S. image in the Arab world, and at a time when that is critical in places like Iraq.
Do you think, Anthony Cordesman, that both the U.S. and Israel have walked into a trap set by Iran, that the plan all along was to destabilize the region by drawing Israel first to Gaza and then to the border with Lebanon?
Well, I think, frankly, when you look back at this, looking for some intelligent master plan in the Middle East has been, shall we say, a little unrealistic for nearly half a century. But the history here is that Hezbollah goes in and takes a couple of Israeli prisoners. Israel massively escalates. Hezbollah escalates back. This is not something that I suspect Hezbollah counted on, and certainly for Hezbollah there are risks as this escalation has risen. It isn't simply Israel that's going to be resented in Lebanon once this is over. No, I think the great problem we have is a whole group of independent movements pursuing goals which are mutually disruptive and which threaten the overall security of the region.
You were saying that Hezbollah is going to be impacted as well because of what's happened, and we've been hearing that from Lebanese who are outraged at its unilateral, move across the border to Israel. But is that possibly what, Israel and the U.S. and other backers of their actions are counting on? That, perhaps
counting
that'll
come on to do what?
To undermine Hezbollah?
Well, the Lebanese hostile in part at Hezbollah may really not accomplish anything other than to divide the Lebanese further on confessional lines. This doesn't really help this situation any more than somehow having divisions between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority helped either in moving toward the peace process or bringing Israel's security.
What do you think Israel should have done after the capture of two soldiers and the killing of others?
Well, I think there's an extremely dangerous signal here for Israel. When it shows it is this sensitive, and I understand the domestic politics, to having a few soldiers captured or killed, it makes itself vulnerable. It commits itself to, every time this happens, essentially overreacting in ways which are predictable and which can be exploited. And it also exposes one of the great problems in Israeli strategy, because a reliance on unilateral settlements and barrier defenses always presented the problem that it would be an incentive to have tunnels, mortars, rockets, attacks on Israelis outside Israel. The fact is that it was pursuing a flawed security strategy from the start, and all this has done is expose how flawed it is.
Anthony Cordesman, a security analyst with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. In coming days, we'll speak with an analyst who backs U.S. policy. You're listening to Here and Now. And we have news here in the Boston area that will affect tourists from all over the country. Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney has ordered an immediate shutdown of the portion of the Ted Williams Tunnel that leads directly to Boston's Logan Airport. This comes as investigations continue into the failure of another portion of a Big Dig Tunnel last week when a huge ceiling tile fell and killed a woman. This decision is bound to further tie up traffic here and raise even more questions. We're going to address one of them today. If you've ever hung a heavy picture frame, you may also be scratching your head over the questions about those ceiling tiles and how they were attached. At the heart of the investigations is the question of whether some of the ceiling support bolts were ever tested, and whether a system that used epoxy, a form of glue, instead of, say, anchored molly bolt type fixtures, was safe enough to help support those ceiling panels. John Christian is an engineer hired to investigate for the Massachusetts Turnpike Authority. He joins us on the line. Welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
John, as you well know, this is a $14.6 billion federally funded project. You've had a close-up look at it. Is it possible that, as a lot of people are thinking, that engineers used a system that we might not use to hang a heavy mirror? I mean, are you having the same question that a lot of people are having?
I think that is a legitimate question. However, this technology of using epoxy to hold the bolt in is a fairly widely used technology, and there are standards for using it.
And what are some of the other places where it might be used?
Well, there are, for example, there are galleries and dams where you have to hang things from the ceilings. There are places where roads go under bridges, and you have to hang things from the bridges. There are places in buildings where you have to hang things from the ceiling and so forth.
So what went wrong here? And by the way, we should say this was sort of a lowered ceiling because there was an airspace between these cement tiles and the other ceiling so that air could flow through. But some people are saying that epoxy doesn't work in situations like this because, first of all, the cement was so heavy. But secondly, doesn't epoxy over time get brittle and dry?
Well, that's why you have an inspection program for these things. There is on these tunnels a 3-year inspection cycle. At least that's the one that's in place now. I suspect that in the future it might be a somewhat shorter inspection cycle that they will use.
And we know that there's an inspection that was scheduled for next month, and part of the investigation is finding out is if past inspections have happened
right,
as they were supposed to. But meanwhile, what's happening now? What are construction crews doing to shore up the tunnels?
Well, what they're doing is they are taking down some of the panels, and they're going to replace a lot of these epoxied-in bolts where they turn out to be needed with a different kind of bolt, which basically has an expanded head on it, which is ground into the concrete and which acts as a mechanical anchor rather than a glued anchor.
Meanwhile, as the construction crews install these new sort of anchor molly bolts, if you will, we understand they're coming across another issue, which is that these huge concrete slabs have steel grids installed in them, and you don't know where they are until you start drilling, and if you come across one, you have to start over again.
Yeah, let me make two minor corrections. First place, when you use the molly bolt analogy, that's not entirely accurate, because in order to use a molly bolt, you go all the way through the wall you're talking about, and then the molly bolt expands in back of it.
Ah.
In these cases, these ceilings are sufficiently thick, so you can't do that, and in some cases, you would actually wind up going all the way through the tunnel, and thus you now start having a leak problem because there's water up there and so forth. The problem is not in the panels themselves. It's in the structural ceiling. The structural ceiling is reinforced concrete. And reinforced concrete is, of course, reinforced by steel bars. And in some cases, this mesh of steel bars is really quite dense. And so if you go drilling holes in there, you cut some of the steel bars, in which case the steel bars don't function as they are designed to function. So the issue of cutting the reinforcing bars is something that has to be addressed, and you have to see how many of them you're cutting, whether this makes a difference, can you do any repairs, and so forth.
So you've been down on these, you know, closed portions of these huge, you know, beautiful tunnels in many ways. Is it nerve-wracking down there? I mean, what's it like to be in this empty tunnel where, you know, there are now questions about what's happening above your head?
The panels themselves, the ones that came down, are no longer there. But it's kind of eerie because you're here in a large tunnel because you don't want the crews to get in each other's way. There are not too many people down there. It's eerie. I think is one of the ways to express it.
Yeah, I would imagine. John Christian, again, an engineer investigating Boston's tunnels. John, good luck to you.
Thank you.
And thank you.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. headed into a busy weekend in the world of sports. The British Open golf tournament teed off in England today, and the champion will be crowned on Sunday. That's the same day the Tour de France cycles to its conclusion in Paris. So, joining us in the studio, only a game host, Bill Littlefield, to give us, those of us who only tune in at the end, to give us a preview.
And you've got golf tournament teed off. You're all right.
I'm all right. Okay. That's okay. Well, you know, it is true that Tour de France in particular, many people don't follow it through every stage, and now it's sort of really heating up. But there's been a story that's been going on throughout. This is the story of the American rider Floyd Landis. He jumped back into the championship chase in a very dramatic way. Tell us about his hip.
Well, his hip, he has a necrotic condition in the ball and socket joint of one of his hips, which means basically that the bone is dead. It hasn't been receiving adequate blood supply for 3 years since he had a terrible accident, a bicycle crash. And he's already announced that directly after the Tour de France, he's going to have his hip replaced. He's going to have that surgery.
How
and he's
is he
been
doing
riding.
This?
Well, he has apparently, and I only know this because I read a wonderful article in the New York Times Sunday magazine a week ago. Apparently, he has worn a kind of groove into the hip. He's kind of made a secondary path for the joint to travel since it doesn't really work the way it's supposed to anymore. And he's been riding on this since late 2003.
Well, and some kind of riding. Apparently, something happened today in one of the stages.
Yes, but what happened today can't really be understood unless you understand what happened yesterday. He had been the leader until yesterday. He had gotten the yellow jersey back again before yesterday's ride. He had a terrible ride yesterday, lost 8 minutes to the leader, and made up 7.5 of those minutes today. Now, usually what happens when people collapse in the Tour de France is they stay collapsed, and they don't come back this way. So it's really quite a dramatic story.
Very dramatic. We'll watch that. And then golf, the British Open, the focus on Tiger Woods, the defending champion. Some say, though, he's struggling after taking time off when his dad died.
He struggled initially after taking time off. He hadn't played for quite a long stretch, and he struggled in the U.S. Open. But he played very well in the Western Open a week ago, and I think there's no reason to believe that he won't perform very well in the British Open, although I'm rooting for Colin Montgomery because he's old, and he's never won the British Open, and I think it would be nice if he won.
And is he? I'm embarrassed to ask. British?
Yes, he is, and he's also far behind. I mean, unhappily. But for those who like varied kinds of people appearing on the top of the leaderboard, my sources inform me that the top nine players as we speak, and the tournament is still underway, include an Englishman, two Australians, a South Korean, a Finn, a Spaniard, a Canadian, a South African, and one American. So it's a nice mix.
Well, and
there.
It would be nice. I don't think a British winner has won in a long time.
Not
a
in a long time. No European in quite, or no Brit in quite a long time.
Well, it's summer, so we just have to mention baseball. I went to the Red Sox game yesterday, by the way. Nothing happened. Well, no, there was one home run. They won.
You're not one of those people who believes that a 1-0 baseball game is dull, are you?
No, not at all.
Okay, good.
But the former Negro League baseball star Buck O'Neill separately was back on the field this week at the age of 94. Just tell us why.
He had two at-bats in a minor league all-star game in order to claim the distinction of oldest baseball player to play in a pro game. He walked in his first at-bat. He was replaced at first base by a pinch runner and then was traded to the other team so that he could have another at-bat right away.
A great story. And there will be more on your program, Only a Game, this weekend on NPR. So we just have to ask real quick. We know you talked to Martina Navratilova. Yes or no, is she retiring?
She says she is, and having seen how fit she looks, I don't believe her for a minute.
Well, good. Well, that's sort of the headline, but the conversation's going to be terrific. You can catch it on Bill Littlefield's program, Only a Game, this weekend on NPR. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, as we just mentioned, the Tour de France ends in Paris this Sunday, but in Somerville, Massachusetts, there's a pack of cyclists whose bike tour never really ends. The Subversive Choppers Urban Legion, a.k.a. Skull, hits the streets of Somerville and neighboring Cambridge and other towns around Boston every Saturday night. Producer Nina Mitchell went along for a very weird ride.
In Skull, everyone takes on a new identity, and no one uses their real name.
I'm Spooky.
Hi, I'm Beeswax.
My name is Nosepicker.
I think that grown-ups forget how to play. I think it's a tragedy. I think that people need to loosen up a little bit and not worry about what they're supposed to be doing.
That's Fleet Admiral Skunk, who founded the group 11 years ago, inspired by other chopper gangs around the country. Skunk is 36. His civilian job is as a fabricator of high-end bikes. There are about 100 members in his gang, although 30 on average join the ride each week. But before they head out, the members drift into a Somerville basement, which is crammed with 50 or so bikes of all sizes. Some are 7 or 8 feet tall, vertically welded on top of each other, like bike stilts. One bike has a functional blender. Beeswax is sanding metal parts.
My favorite bike is called Vertigo. It was built by a pilot named Moose, and it's very tall and has a really long wheelbase. It's a beautiful ship.
Here's a quick lesson in Skull's lingo. The cyclists are pilots. Their bikes are a fleet of ships, and the basement is their fort. And Skunk says Skull lives in space.
We fly ships around star systems. We're in the Somerville system now, and we'll visit constellations, you know, Harvard constellation, Porter constellation, and the squares around town.
Every Saturday night, around 10:30, Skunk and his gang cycle around Somerville and beyond. The pack of men and women aged 20 to 40 howl, ring their bike bells, dance, stop to get naked. Well, more on that part later in the story.
Warning, 10 minutes left until sign-in. Debrief report to level 2 to commence manual playback procedure.
As it grows closer to liftoff, members turn up in a lot of black, wearing their insignia, a flying skull. They pilot their ships to a launch pad. In lay terms, that's a parking lot nearby. Then, in an elaborately choreographed ritual, they line up, high-five their navigator, and blast off. Skull squeals past Davis Square, Porter Square, Harvard Square, high-fiving pedestrians as drivers honk their horns. At Central Square, they rest and refuel, mostly on junk food, and dance in front of the 7-Eleven, then on to Medford. They like running over leftover plastic cups in the street. Skull gives out points for things like that. Also for high-fiving and acts of valor. The riders' points get tallied, and they might get medals at the end of the night. At 1 in the morning, the fleet docks at Lower Mystic Lake in Arlington. The pilots turn off the funk music and hide the bikes from civilian and official eyes. In the pre-dawn hush of the lake, half of Skull goes skinny dipping. The other half dips into beverages instead.
You have to come out of the water. I just don't want to get the bag wet.
Before the sun comes up, Skull turns back for home, more tired, more subdued. They reach the Somerville launch pad at around 3 a.m. and announce medals. They put their ships away in the fort and scatter anonymously back to their civilian lives for another week. As for this civilian, the group gave me an honorary alias, the name given to the very last bike in the Tour de France, Lanton Rouge.
Lanton Rouge, also known as Nina Mitchell, when she's not riding with the Subversive Choppers Urban League in Cambridge and Somerville. To see pictures of their bikes, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the